You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Welcome, friend. I'm TK, your tour guide to the past, and you are listening to For the Love of History, the podcast where we talk about world history, women's history, and weird history. How are you feeling today, my delicious little donut? Earlier, I messed up the intro, and that's crazy. I think it is the first sign of the apocalypse. If we hear a giant horn go, and then the four horsemen come, you know that it's my fault. I have never messed up this intro in 122 episodes, and I did today, so I had to take a second take, but it's in the bloopers, so enjoy it in the bloopers. Anyways, how are you feeling today, my delicious little donut? I hope that you are ready for some history that is adjacent to your nickname namesake, because we're talking about the ridiculously long history of pancakes. But before we do, let's get into some housekeeping. Firstly, if you haven't already, please go over to YouTube, subscribe. It's one of the best free 99 ways to help support the podcast. Here's a little behind the scenes. You cannot start monetizing on YouTube unless you have a certain amount of subscribers. That first threshold is 1,000, and we're so close to 1,000. And then there's a whole thing about watch hours. You have to have a certain number of watch hours. So by subscribing and watching over on YouTube, you are helping the podcast grow. And it's really, really appreciated. So go head on over there. There's a link in the show notes. You'll love it. We have so much fun. Second order of business is the fourth anniversary of For the Love of History podcast is coming on April 1st. I cannot believe it's been 4 years. That's wild. So we're going to do something really special, something that we've never done before. We're going to do a live history quiz game. There's going to be prizes and laughs, and it's going to be so much fun. And if you'd like to participate, all you have to do is sign up using the link in the show notes, and then the quiz game link will be sent to you when the time comes. So go ahead and check out that in the show notes too. The show notes is just a great place to be. It's a great place to look. And there will also be some super special Patreon only live events and activities. So if you'd like to attend Patreon only events, membership starts at only $2. That's like 2 pennies a day. And you get so many cool extra little history tidbits. There's early releases on podcast episodes. There's reaction videos that only go up on Patreon. There's a monthly newsletter. There's ad-free listening. There's other cool little research thingies that I send out all the time. There's so many fun things on there. So if you would like to help support the podcast in that way, you can go head over to Patreon. And finally, the last order of business is the super spectacular History BFF trip that has launched. There are 2 more spots available, early bird spots. These tickets will save you $200 on the ticket price, and you only need to pay 25% to confirm your spot, because you can pay in installments up to 90 days before the trip in October. And you can find all of this information again in the show notes. I really hope to see you there. We're gonna float down the Nile. We're gonna go see Hatshepsut. We're gonna go see the Pyramid of Giza. We're going to go to Luxor. We're going to go to all sorts of museums. We're going to get toured around by actual archaeologists. It's going to be absolutely wonderful. So I hope to see you there. And the true final order of business is, do you like my sweater? Because I made it. If you don't like it, don't tell me. It's my first sweater. So, you know, there's room for improvement, but I really like it a lot. So if you don't, never let me know. Okay, we're finally done with the housekeeping. So let's get on to the pancakes. Now, I know this may seem like a very random topic, but if you live in my brain, you would see the very clear thought process. So let me walk you through how I came up with this topic. All right. One day I was cooking dinner and I thought to myself, hey, when was the first time in history somebody did this? Somebody cooked things and put them together. So I Googled it. And while I was deep in the trenches of the hyperlink Google swamp that I was in, I burned my chicken. Completely burned it. But the chicken sacrifice was not in vain, for I learned the answer to my question. And now, with the spirit of that burnt chicken breast in mind, let us grab the syrup of your choice and that culinary tool of the devil, aka the fork, and let's get to it. Flapjacks, crepes, Moroccan mesemme, buttermilk pancakes, hotcakes, Japanese souffle cakes, blintz, griddle cake, Korean pancakes, slapjacks, German Dutch babies, Scotch pancakes, and hoe cakes. These are just some of the hundreds of pancake varieties that we have in this world. Not to mention all of the different additives like blueberries, lemon curd, chocolate chips, cinnamon, icing. All things that add even more variety to the great pancake list. I have a close and personal relationship with Dad's Pancakes at the Griddle in Boise, Idaho. They are perfection. My mom and I would go over to this place called Serendipity, and we would, it's a thrift store, and we would go, we would thrift, and then we would have brunch at the Griddle. I have some very fine memories with pancakes. I love them. And this episode and research of this episode has only made me love pancakes even more. So the day that I burnt my chicken, I found out two very important things. One, the pancake may be one of the most universally made food items in history. And two, the first pancake was made 70,000 years ago. I'll pause to let you soak that all in. The humble pancake was around 70,000 years ago. This means that Neanderthals? Let's Google that really quick. Hold on.
Neanderthal.
Right? I was right. I shouldn't have never doubted myself. Anyways, Neanderthals were chowing down on some pancake cakes. Before we dive into the history of pancakes, let's just give some context. Let's have a mini lesson on who the Neanderthals were. Basically, Neanderthals, along with a group called Denisovans, found in Asia, Neanderthals are our closest human relatives. They're colloquially known as cavemen, but they're not the ooga booga, whatever, clubbing you in the head type of cavemen. Okay. They're called cavemen because they often lived in caves. While our ancestors, Homo sapiens, were evolving in Africa, the Neanderthals evolved in Europe and Asia. The earliest known Neanderthal fossils are around 430,000 years old. And while they weren't what we call humans now, many humans today have around 2% Neanderthal DNA, and I am one of those humans. Through the power of 23andMe, I discovered that I am genetically dispositioned to like cilantro, and I also have 2% Neanderthal DNA, which is incredible. This is not sponsored by 23andMe, by the way, but if, you know, anybody from the 23andMe team is listening, I would not mind a sponsorship, but I will digress. Because they're so old, because Neanderthals are so old, information on them is limited. However, thanks to the work of many archaeologists, we now have a more full picture of what they were like, how they lived, and what they ate. Before 2022, it was believed that Neanderthals didn't do any complex cooking. that they had super high meat diets that they would just fling on a fire and then eat no processed or low processed plants like berries and tubers. You don't have to do a lot to make a berry or a potato taste very good. So these are what are known as low or no processed foods. However, and this is possibly one of the biggest howevers in For the Love of History, inside two caves, one in Greece and one in Iraq, some paleoethnobotanists, which is a mouthful, anthropologists, and ethnographers discovered a Paleolithic pancake. Through carbonized plant food remains, they were able to uncover that not only were Neanderthals making complex dishes, they were also using complex techniques to process the food. And that food was the proto-pancake. Now, I won't get too specific on how they found all of this out, but I will put the research paper that I read in the show notes. So if you'd like to take a look, you can. But basically, the paper says that through microscopic examination of the charred food remains, it revealed the use of pounded pulses, which is a common ingredient in cooked plant foods. So pulses are basically like lentils, chickpeas, things of that nature. So the Neanderthals were pounding them into like a flour type substance. Then they also determined that these ground pulses were mixed with other plant foods and turned into a pancake-like batter. Then they were cooked on a hot stone and voila, proto pancakes, which is incredible. 70,000 year old pancakes. Another big name in pancake history is our dear friend Ötzi the caveman. Unfortunately for Ötzi, but fortunately for us, he was shot in the back by an arrow and became an ice mummy in the Tyrolean Alps between Italy and Austria. He was so well preserved that we know what his last meal was, along with a hearty helping of red deer and ibex, which is a kind of like great horny goat. Mr. Iceman's tum-tum had the remains of what seems to be a pancake made of acorn wheat. Einkorn wheat. It's a kind of grain. Some archaeologists think it was a porridge. However, because of the bits of charcoal mixed in with that acorn wheat, more archaeologists are leaning to the side of pancake than porridge. From 70,000 years ago to 5,300 years ago, the pancake sizzled through history, traveling via word of mouth in the great tradition of oral history. It wasn't until around 500 BCE that we get the first written record of pancakes, and it came in the form most fitting of such an important and delicious vessel of human history, a poem. The Athenian poet Cratinus wrote, "A pancake, hot and shedding morning dew," which according to Anne Treistman in her book Foodie Facts, A Food Lover's Guide to Americans' Favorite Dishes, quote, "No one knows the exact context in which the sentence was placed, but Cratinus was most likely referring to Greek pancakes or tigonites, as they were called. 600 years after this pancake poem in the late 2nd century CE, Greek physician Galen introduced a pancake recipe in his On the Properties of Foodstuffs that's similar to a Russian bellini or like a Canadian griddle cake. Canadian griddle cake. He wrote, "The oil is placed in a frying pan that is put on a smokeless fire, and when it becomes hot, the wheaten flour soaked in a large amount of water is poured into it." He also wrote that these little griddle cakes were often eaten with honey, so they were a sweet treat. Not long after our poet friend Cratinus wrote about the Greek pancakes, China and Egypt also were catching up on the pancake craze. They were using local wheats or grains and creating their version of sometimes sweet, sometimes savory pancakes. And from there, the pancake spread across the world.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Pancakes, dear one, are like a thermometer for the cultural climate of the time. They have their finger on the pulse of society. Often born from necessity, pancakes can tell us all we need to know about what was going on at the time of their creation or popularity. I call it the pancake social meter. For example, in China, according to legend, in the Three Kingdoms period from 220 to 280 CE, there was a massive war going on. And more than ammunition, armies need food. Yeah, I got a big army. That's awesome. Yeah, I gotta feed them. And a chancellor of one of the armies was struggling really hard to find a good way to feed his soldiers because he was blessed with a big old army. However, they had lost their cooking supplies during battle. How you do that, we will never know. But he challenged his cooks to come up with something to feed his men to increase morale and to fill their bellies. And what his cooks came up with was a runny mixture of water and wheat flour. And with no pans to cook with, according to legend, the soldiers laid out their copper shields and fried those bad boys up on their shields, creating a lovely little crepe. The morale of the soldiers immediately went up. They were fed and happy, and maybe they won the war. I have no idea. This episode is about pancakes, not war. These delicious little snacks grew in popularity, and as peace spread through China, the pancakes got more and more complicated and flavorful and took on a life of their own in each place they went. And actually, I'd like to retract my previous statement. This episode is a little bit about war because pancakes and war go hand in hand. And that's a sentence I never thought I would say, but here we are. And they really do. Combining water or in some cases alcohol with a grain of your choice is one of the easiest ways to fill hungry bellies. And many a siege has caused human beings to get very creative with their food choices, from eating zoo animals to grinding up any grain they can find and making it stretch as long as possible. And this is what happened in Paris. When Prussia besieged Paris for 4 months in 1870 and 1871, bread became scarce, and so did flour. So many a Parisian turned to the low-class, ordinary food of the common folk, the crepe, aka skinny pancakes. And these skinny pancakes helped people stretch their wheat, stretch their grains much longer than it would have if they were making big, fluffy, soft bread. And from there, they became popular. And the more peace and prosperity, just like in China, the more delicious they became. Because peace equals delicious food. You don't got anything else going on, so you might as well eat some good food. Ingredients of pancakes can also tell us a ton about what is going on during the time in which they were made. For example, the creation of potato pancakes in Europe. As an Idaho girl, not that I was born in Idaho, but I lived there for a while and my family still lives there, I am fully in love with the potato pancake in all of its forms. And if it wasn't for some Spanish conquistadors, there would not be pancakes made of potatoes. I was quite old when I found out that the staple food of my pasty white European ancestors, the potatoes, came from Europe via Spanish conquistadors in Peru during the 1500s, 1536 to be precise. Before that, there were no potatoes in Europe. And when potatoes finally came over to Europe, only the poor ate them because they were easy to grow. They were cheaper than wheat to grow. You needed less space. It was just a win-win situation. And the aristocrats were like, ew, potatoes, gross. They had no idea what they were missing out on. But I digress. Out of necessity, once again, these potatoes were used in a way that would stretch them out for longer, creating hearty dishes with less ingredients to fill the belly. The creation of the potato pancake was once again created out of necessity. Social norms and beliefs of the time can also be sussed out via pancake history. I'm telling you, dear one. Pancakes know all. They know all of the secrets of history. And some of these secrets are awful, unfortunately. Indigenous people in what is now known as the United States were making griddle cakes, often called bannock, for centuries. Each tribe had their own variations. Some used lichen, others used wheat, some used wild rice. So many things were used. The European pancake, however, came to us in the 1800s, and by the 1880s, someone had come up with an easy, self-rising mix, which seems pretty innocuous. A logical step in the evolution of the pancake. But if we look closer at what was going on in the 1880s, we can see a different picture. It was the height of the Second Industrial Revolution, and people were working ungodly hours, and they needed something quick and easy and filling to have for breakfast because the Fair Labor Standards Act would not be around for another 50, 60 years, which guaranteed people the right to have lunch, a lunch break. So many of these people would just eat their one meal in the morning and work all day. In steps our heroine, the pancake. Thick, fluffy, fatty, filling, and now in an easy-to-make mix made by a company started by two garbage humans, unfortunately. Pearl Milling Company began in 1888 and decided to name their mix Aunt Jemima. Now, if you're in the U.S., you've probably seen this brand, which it's thankfully rebranded, but the name was chosen because of a famous minstrel song from 1875. If you don't know what a minstrel show is, it's an incredibly racist stereotype portrayal of black people played by a white person in blackface. Unfortunately, at this time, minstrel shows were incredibly popular, which is why the men chose it for brand recognition and popularity. And I could go on and on about this topic. So if you'd like to read more about the history of Aunt Jemima pancakes and how it changed to Pearl Milling Company, I'm going to leave a really great NPR article in the show notes below, and you can read all about it. But I wanted to tell you this one little fact, that the name changed from Aunt Jemima to Pearl Milling Company in June of 2021. 3 years ago, less than 3 years ago. But anyways, I will leave links in the show notes for you if you want to read more about that. But I digress. Pancakes, war, famine, colonization, racism, and the Industrial Revolution are inseparable. But the history of pancakes is not all doom and gloom, dear one. Nay, nay. There is also joy in the pancake. I'm about to say something controversial, yet brave. There is no happier food on earth than pancakes, with the possible exception of ice cream cake, and that is the only other contender that I will accept. And I invite you, I challenge you, to sit in front of a stack of flapjacks with a side of your favorite syrup, be it maple, be it raspberry, chocolate, whatever syrup suits your fancy. Sit in front of that stack of flapjacks, and try to be sad. Just try. Try it out. It's impossible. You can't do it. I don't make the rules. The science people do. I am just here as a messenger of the facts. How do I know this is a fact? I hear you asking, dear one. I love that you keep asking questions. Trust, but verify always, okay? I know that this is a fact because pancakes are celebratory foods all over the world and have been for thousands of years, okay? Example number one, we cannot talk about pancake celebration without talking about Shrove Tuesday, also known as Pancake Day, which is my best friend Chloe's favorite day of the year. I love you, Chloe. I know you're listening. I'll talk to you later. If you are not privy to the glory of Shrove Tuesday, aka Pancake Day, let me tell you about it. It all starts with the Catholics. The Catholics never cease to amaze, confuse, befuddle, and amuse me. Going all the way back to 100 CE, people began using the Tuesday before Lent, which is a period in which Catholics and many other Christians give up things and reflect on their sins. You can't indulge during this time, which meant that you couldn't have dairy, you couldn't have eggs, and you could not have sugar. So what people began doing is going absolutely ham on some pancakes. They made a ton of buttery, sweet, decadent pancakes, chowing down and having a little morning party to get all that sin out, and then going to church and confessing your sins so that when Ash Wednesday rolled around and Lent started, you were too hungover and stuffed with flapjacks to care about not being able to eat them for like 40 days. And that is the origin of Shrove Tuesday, aka Pancake Day. A less raucous celebration involving pancakes comes from China during the Lunar New Year's. A savory pancake called a chengyu bing is served, and the making and the eating of them are family affairs. They're delicious and savory, and a little bit crispy. If you've never had them, I highly recommend that you do. But the celebratory pancakes don't stop there. During the Jewish holiday of Passover, Jewish people don't eat leavened bread, which is bread that has yeast in it and it rises and it gets fluffy. So instead, they have creme slash, and it's a bread pudding pancake covered in sugar, and it looks absolutely delicious. Celebratory pancakes also translated into literature. In the book Grapes of Wrath, the Jode family eats pancakes with syrup and sugar after Al announces his engagement. But there's more. Shakespeare, that freaking guy, had to get in on the pancake action. He has two plays that reference pancakes. One in Pericles, in his play Pericles, a fisherman says, "Come, thou shalt go home, and we'll have flesh for holidays, fish for fasting days, and more puddings and flapjacks, and thou shalt be welcome." The second time he talked about pancakes is in the play As You Like It. And I don't know if I like it, because he says that one of the characters likes to eat pancakes with mustard. And I'm not here to yuck someone else's yum, but mustard and pancakes? No, absolutely not. But I mean, who am I to judge? I love sour cream and jelly sandwiches, so I guess I'm gross too. But I digress. Across the world, pancakes are not only used as celebrations, but as everyday meal staples. In Ethiopia, you have injera, a very large flat pancake made of teff flour, and it's literally the base of the food. It's used as both a plate and an eating utensil. You rip off a piece and you scoop up your food that's on the injera. And I'm telling you right now, you definitely should hop onto Google. Google your closest Ethiopian restaurant. Go have injera and then end your meal with the sweet avocado smoothie. Heaven, you will. There's no turning back. There's no turning back from sweet avocado. So good. In nearly every country and every culture, there is some sort of pancake. From the sweet Korean hotok to the savory jjan to Indonesian martabak, Indian roti, Moroccan mismeng, Dutch babies, and so much more. Pancakes are like delicious circular archivists that have satisfied hungry tummies for 70,000 years and will hopefully continue to do so for thousands more. Well, dear one, we have come to our final thought, and it is a hilarious little dip into the scientific world. So I was born in Salina, Kansas, and throughout my life, I have been made fun of for it. From getting told that, Dorothy, you're not in Kansas anymore, to, where's your dog Toto, and jokes about how flat and boring this state are, and numerous people calling Kansas a flyover state, which is rude because it is a beautiful, beautiful place if you know where to go. But in 2003, a trio of geographers took the jokes about the flatness of Kansas to their scientific zenith. After an extremely dull, to them, trip across the American Midwest, they were making jokes that Kansas was flatter than a pancake. And being trained geographers with very high-tech and expensive surveying technology, they decided to test the theory to really see if Kansas was flatter than a pancake. So what they did was construct a topographical profile of both a pancake and Kansas. They found a control pancake at the International House of Pancakes, IHOP, and using a laser and something called a confocal laser microscope, they created that topographical map. And then using data from the United States Geological Survey, they published their findings in something called the Annals. Oh my God. not the Annals. I'm sorry. The Annals of Improbable Research, which is a hilarious research paper. It's so good. So in their findings, they showed that though pancakes are flat, Kansas is even flatter. So basically, this is quoted from their research article, where mathematically a value of 1.000 indicates perfect tabletop flatness, Kansas scored a particularly horizontal 0.9997. The pancake, in contrast, scored a relatively lumpy 0.957. And if there's any parents or teachers out there who have kids who are like always asking the question when in math or geography, when am I ever gonna need this in my life? Tell them this story. Tell them that one day they're gonna make an incredible joke and use science to prove that that joke is right and that Kansas is truly flatter scientifically than a pancake. Well, dear one, that is all she wrote. Episode 122 is in the books. We are one episode away from our 4-year anniversary, which I am so excited and grateful to you, all of the delicious donuts out there who have supported the podcast. I'm not going to get too mushy, but if you want to participate in our live history quiz game, go ahead, go to the show notes and sign up so that you can join and participate. And if you would also like to participate in some other things, you could leave a rating or review or both. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, that would be great, or any other platform that allows you to leave a review. That's wonderful. It's such a fantastic little offering to the algorithm gods to let them know that you like this podcast and that other people should also like this podcast. You can also let me know of what you think about this particular episode by using Spotify's question and answer feature. Unfortunately, I cannot answer you. You can only question. End statement. If you'd like to support the podcast in other ways, you can share this or any episode with your other history BFF or somebody who you think should join us here. It's a great community. We love everybody, all right? Unless you're a garbage human, we don't love those. You can also support the podcast by purchasing some absolutely excellent merch as shown here. We've got sweaters, we've got hoodies, we now have stickers and pins and so many more things. So you can hop on over to the merch store and grab your official For the Love of History gear. You can also support the podcast by hopping over to Patreon and enjoying all of the little extra history tiddly bits over there. But if that's not your thing, totally fine. I appreciate you being here. So thank you so much for joining me once again this week. And before I let you go, let me tell you to do something kind for yourself. Go outside, touch some grass, hug something, hug a tree. Hugs are good. Unless you don't like hugs, then that's fine. You don't have to hug anything. But I love hugs. So I'm going to send you one telepathically. If you accept it. Did you feel it? Okay, excellent. Also, make sure to stay hydrated, drink your water, and I will see you in the next episode when we talk about the Island of Maidens. It's gonna be so good. Okay, I'll see you later. Love you. Bye! Why is there a metronome right now? Oh, okay.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.